Hey, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Today I sat down and spoke with Beatrice Abropeshot, a successful freelance copywriter. Beatrice shares her insights into the challenges and rewards of the digital nomad lifestyle and her personal journey from hospitality to becoming a sought-after freelance copywriter in the tech and web-free space. We also discuss whether or not you should niche down and how niche is too niche. And most importantly, we talk about the challenges of landing your first freelance client and how to overcome them. I hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you want to support us, then please subscribe and share. Let's jump right in. How are you doing today, Beatrice?
Oh, that was perfect pronunciation. I'm good. Although it's kind of foggy in Lisbon, which is not that common. But I'm good despite the fog. And you?
Oh, nice. Yeah. No, I'm all good. We don't have any fog today in Spain here. It's super sunny, actually. It's really nice. We're getting like this spell of really warm weather. It's like mid-winter, but you could literally go outside and sunbathe, or if you're me, you can go outside and get sunburnt. So it's really nice. I think we have a similar climate, right? Spain and Portugal in general.
Yeah, it's pretty similar. I think like in Barcelona you might have like a bit better weather, a bit warmer than in Lisbon, but pretty similar nonetheless.
Yeah, because you got the ocean coming in and creating that cold wind as well. But I think Portugal, especially Lisbon, is like a massive hotspot for freelancers, for digital nomads. People from all over the world congregate there. There is like a massive network, and it's a really cool place to be. I've been there a few times, specifically for like freelance meetups. And you're a freelance copywriter, and in your LinkedIn bio, it specifically says that you're a freelance copywriter for Web3 among SaaS, finance, and tech. But Lisbon seems to be a massive, a Web3 tech hub as well. So are you, because you're originally from Portugal, but do you stay there because of this digital nomad sort of love and lifestyle that Portugal has become known for?
No, it's not actually like the main reason. It's because I'm, as a typical Portuguese person, I'm very connected to my family. So I want to be where my family is. So that's mainly why I'm based here. Huge plus being in a city that's becoming a digital nomad capital and also a huge Web3 hub. Definitely born in the right place.
Yeah. Have you ever been to ETH Lisbon?
No, I haven't. I've just been to the Web Summit, and so I'm still have to join that one.
Ah, nice. Yeah, I went, I think it may have been last year or the year before. Maybe it was last year. I think I went last year, and I participated in the hackathon at ETH Lisbon, which was a really cool event. It was a really cool experience. It was my first ever time at a hackathon. But yeah, I have to say, it was such a good experience, and there was loads of people there, you know, all competing to win those like cash prizes that they had there on the day. But I did, whilst I was in, because this was, so it was in Lisbon, I got this mixed feeling whilst I was there, right? As a freelancer, or kind of more as a digital nomad at that time, like, you know, I come just with a backpack and a laptop. When I would try and go into certain cafes or restaurants and just, you know, work as a nomad, sometimes the people would be pissed and they would tell you to leave the cafe. You can't work here. You can't do this. And they were really against that sort of remote work lifestyle. But then, you know, other places were for it. But have you experienced that side of Lisbon where they're sort of kind of against the digital nomad?
Oh my God, 100%. 100%. And also, especially because even before I was a freelancer, I worked in the hospitality industry in Lisbon. And there are a lot of mixed feelings with tourism in Portugal. So I guess it kind of depends. Some people want to focus on the the bad side of it, and others want to focus on the good side of it. So so the truth is that having a lot of digital nomads in Portugal was a big factor in driving the rent prices up. So living in and renting a place in the center of Portugal is not really an option for a Portuguese person that is earning a Portuguese wage. So I guess that's what's mainly put people off digital nomads and tourism. But again, like, I believe that having the tourism and digital nomads in Portugal really helped, like, rehabilitate the city. I remember when I was really young, like, my grandparents lived in the heart of Alfama, which is the most touristic neighborhood in Lisbon. And I remember going there at night, and it was all, like, really dark, really shady. It was not really safe to walk around at night. And now I feel safe walking around at night anywhere in Lisbon. So I do think that tourism contributed a lot to that. Also, and even if you look at old movies that were shot in Portugal, you could see the buildings were just in a horrible shape. And now you still see a few of them like that, unfortunately, but most of them have been rehabilitated. So it really changed the city for the better, I believe. Unfortunately, it made it not as affordable for Portuguese, but I guess it's like with everything, you have pros and cons.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've seen, because it became a hub for crypto as well as like the digital nomad and freelancer movement, it became a hub for crypto in the Web3 space. I'm pretty sure it's because there was very lenient and, you know, nice tax reliefs for crypto. So everybody with a decent amount of money in crypto moved to Portugal in order to, you know, pay less taxes and still be in like a very nice, beautiful city and a very nice place to live. So I can imagine, because if when you're in the center of Lisbon, like, you see like 25-year-old Renault drive past, and then behind it is like a brand new McLaren or Ferrari. It's like this odd mix of like, there's this like bunch of like crypto millionaires, and then there's like the normal working Portuguese person. And yeah. I did have a few conversations out there that were the same as this, that I think it was of a taxi driver that was telling me that like they hate the crypto community and they hate the digital nomads because they've come with this external money and just pushed all the natives outside by just driving the rent prices through the roof. So I guess this happens in like a lot of places. I don't know, but I'm assuming it's kind of a similar scenario in Bali and like these other places where you see like these like hot spots for freelancers and digital nomads. And I guess, yeah, pros and cons to it all. But like, moving forward on that, like, let's jump into you and your personal story a little bit. So how did you get started with freelancing? So what is your origin story?
So it's a bit of a long one, because it was definitely not something that I was expecting to find myself in. So I initially actually wanted to be a veterinarian, and my grades weren't that good. So I got into what is zootechnical engineering. So it's basically animal production engineering. And while I was paying for my master's degree, I had to start working in a hostel. So I fell in love with the tourism industry, and so started going from there, because zootechnical engineering was not gonna cut it, because the job opportunities were horrible. So I ended up going down the rabbit hole of the hospitality industry in Portugal, which was booming at the time. And I was thinking, and everyone in the tourism industry was thinking, oh, this is like a sure deal. Like, if you work in hospitality in Portugal, you're set for life. That was until the pandemic hit. So when the pandemic hit, unfortunately, a lot of the tourism industry was the biggest one that got hit in Portugal. And it was also one of the main ones that drives the Portuguese economy. So that was a huge hit. And so at the time, I was working as a consultant, and so I was basically unemployed. And throughout my time working in hostels, I crossed paths with a lot of digital nomads and freelancers. And I kept thinking to myself, like, it's so cool what they're doing. But I think it's, you need to have like a very specific skill to do that. You need to either know how to code or to be a web designer. And so when I found myself without any job, and there wasn't even the time to look for another job in the hospitality industry, I knew I had to do something else and completely change careers. And so I thought, well, if I have this opportunity to start from scratch, let me do something that I really want to do and that I really find is going to help me be, well, have a job for as long as I want. So that's when I thought back to those freelancers and digital nomads and thought to myself, well, I need to find a way to make this work. But if I don't know how to code or how to design, what skill can I offer as a service? So when I was Googling the hell out of how to be a freelancer, I stumbled upon content writing and copywriting. And I thought to myself, well, it's not that I think that I'm a great writer. At the time, I didn't think that at all. But let's see what I can do with this. Also, the fact that it's something that can be applied to any industry and any kind of business was a huge factor for me to go into this the copywriting career, because then I wouldn't be subject to another pandemic, to another like similar crisis. So that's when I started first offering just blog posts, and as I'm a curious person, like I started to learn more and more about it, and naturally progressed into a copywriter.
Nice, that's really cool. And was it difficult for you to find those first clients as a copywriter? So you've now established yourself, okay, I'm a copywriter, I'm gonna do this. And then how was it finding those first couple clients?
Yeah, so I think the hard part of the first client is not actually getting the first client, is having the confidence that you're doing the right thing in order to get it. Because like everything requires consistency in order to work. And especially at first when you don't have your name out there, and also depending on the strategy that you choose, but for sure any strategy will require consistency. And so being consistent when you're not sure if it's going to work, when you have that imposter syndrome, when you don't know anyone that's doing that, is really, really the hardest part, I believe. Because if you're sure that, okay, I have my portfolio set, I know who I want to reach out to, I know how I'm going to reach out to them, as long as you're consistent, you can get there. The problem with me and why I think it took me longer than it should have to get my first client was the fact that I was just changing strategies every week, basically, because I was afraid I was not putting my effort and energy in the right strategy.
Yeah, so you thought you were kind of spreading yourself too thin. You were trying loads of different methods, not sticking to one thing, and therefore not getting momentum with any one sort of channel.
Exactly, and especially when you're starting out, you need to, I think that's the biggest block. It's always mindset and overcoming those insecurities. And also like when you're starting something new, you never know how good you are at it and until you get that first client and you get the feedback. And when you get the feedback, you're like, oh, okay, so I guess this is something I can keep doing, because someone, at least this first client worked out. So
yeah,
let's get
exactly
on to the next one.
Yeah, you need that positive feedback loop. Like when you get that first review from the client, great job, and like you see the results that your work produced, and then you start to get that confidence boost, and then you can go on to the next client, charge more money.
Yeah, exactly. Like overcoming the first hurdles until you get that validation, it's really, really hard. And I guess I would say that the biggest challenge are in that phase, because you don't really have any, you haven't proved to yourself that you're able to do it. You just have to believe in it. You just have to have faith in yourself. So, and it's really hard to ask from someone that is looking to get that revenue and is looking to start something completely different.
Yeah, for me, I think it's just you need the mindset of I can do anything, even if I don't know how to do it right now, I can learn. Like there's nothing that I can't learn. So just throwing yourself into opportunities and then essentially learning on the job, because there's a lot of people that listen to the podcast and you know, follow us on Instagram and on the courses, and we get a question a lot, which is, I don't have any skills, how can I start freelancing? Well, one is the like, I don't believe that you have no skills at all. You just need to like look harder for what you actually have. But two is that like, okay, like even if you do have no skills, just be willing to learn anything.
Yeah.
You know, experiment. If you're in that beginner stage, which is leading me onto a question that I'm going to ask you now, is that like you became a copywriter, you saw the digital nomads and the freelancers, were inspired to become a freelancer, didn't know what to do, and then stumbled across copywriting and content. And it says now that, you know, you niche, or it looks like your niches are in Web3, SaaS, finance, in tech. Was that the case when you started out as a copywriter?
Not at all. It's so funny. So when I started out, I had to go a little bit against what is, I guess, most people's intuition, which is when someone starts out, their mindset is like, I'll do anything. I'll write for anything. But then on the few people that I was following, the advice was to, you know, niche down and choose something really specific, because that's how you're going to stand out from people that are more experienced than you. And so I was thinking to myself, so what kind of niche can I choose that is super specific? And one question that popped up that was really interesting is was that I should choose a niche that I will never get tired of researching and learning more about. Because you do have to really dive into the concepts of that niche that you pick. And so at the time, I was thinking about this question, and I looked to my side, and my dog was lying on my bed. And I was like, I love dogs and learning about dogs, so this is going to be my niche. And so, yeah, so writing about dogs was my first ever niche. And one thing that is interesting is like people always say that, oh, but if I'm choosing a niche, I'm cutting out other people from reaching out to me. And that is definitely not true, because my whole portfolio was on dogs. Everything, I was marketing myself as a pet content writer. And still I had this accounting software company reaching out to me and asking me to write for them. So it's really not the case that you're excluding anyone if you're niching down. You're just setting yourself apart from anyone else offering the same service.
Yeah, that's true. And it's definitely how you reach those higher levels of payment. Because when an employer is looking to hire a freelancer just to get something done, like, oh, we need someone to do this or that, and they hire a generalist copywriter, they're not looking to pay the most. But if they need something ultra specific, so your example there, like dog, if you dog and pet writing, if, you know, a huge, you know, pet supplies company reaches out to you, it's because you are the go-to person in that industry. And then you've got more bargaining power in the negotiations as well, because they can't compare you against the, you know, the finance writer or the other writer, because there's no direct comparison. So exactly. Yeah, niching down is definitely the way to go.
And also the thing, one very important thing is that if I'm already in that niche and if I already wrote a ton about that niche, then the research time is going to be dramatically cut. So I won't need to research as much about a topic because I already have before for other blog posts. And an even bigger asset I would have writing for that is the fact that I'm writing for a target audience that I'm also a part of. So whenever I wanted to come up with ideas for blog posts, I would always think to myself, like, huh, what would I want to know about my dog, Phoebe? What questions would I have? What concerns would I have? So I would pull a lot of content ideas from those and then, of course, validate them doing keyword research. But that was, a biggest strength of mine, to be able to easily come up with content ideas, because I just had to figure out, like, what were my questions as a dog owner.
Yeah, that's true. I often talk about that in terms of, like, investing to people as well. When me and my friends talk about, you know, what to invest in, this, that, and the other, it's like, well, we can't really see what's going on. And, like, we're not financial analysts. So let's just see what we like, what we understand. So for most of us, like in my friends group, it would be like tech and gaming. We know who the biggest companies are, as in, like, you know, who's hot at the moment, like which of our friends are using these components. And so obviously, like, this component is the best and everybody wants this, but they can't get hold of it. There's such high demand. So then, okay, that seems like a pretty good bet to, like, place an investment in. And I guess, like, that's just something that I've been spinning there off the top of my head. But, like, in the same scenario there, and like with niching, like, if you niche down, whether you're a photographer, copywriter, graphic designer, but you niche down into what you have, you know, your own personal interests in, you draw experience from your day-to-day life. Like you said there, like, oh, okay, like, these thoughts have been popping into my head. What did I want to know about my dog? What questions did I have in the past? I guess it would be the same, like, if I was to go into copywriting for, you know, gaming, is something that I'm not starting from scratch from. I can draw my, like, exactly, own, you know, personal experiences from, like, without having to, like, you know, do my own research. But do you think there's a point of where you can get too niche? So for example, now if I was to say to you, okay, you have to, you know, inside of Web3, you have to go even more niche to Web3, that you only work with Polygon projects, for example. Do you think that would be too niche, or do you think that would enable you to charge even higher rates?
I think the only way where you could say it's too niche is if you didn't have any clients that would be willing to pay and to hire you. I think that's the only telltale sign that you're going too niche. But I think it's a lot easier to narrow down too much and then broaden it up if you need to, than the other way around. Unless, like, the only way I would suggest someone to go a bit broader is if they don't really know what their interests are still. I would still tell them to pick at least one broad niche, but then naturally they'll flow into whatever they feel like they're better at and where their actual interests lie. And it's all about, I think it's a lot of testing the waters as well, because I also don't believe that we, at this point, we already know what interests we'll have, like, in a few months, in a year. So it might be that if we start writing about one industry, we stumble upon another and we find out, oh no, this one's actually like a good industry to start going into. Just being open to that. But again, I really don't think it's possible to go too niche. To be honest, like, a really funny thing, I even saw blog posts where people would write about zombies. So if that is a thing, it's hard to go wrong when picking a niche.
Yeah, true. I mean, yeah, zombies is pretty niche, especially in, like, the world of business. Yeah, but yeah. That's pretty funny. I mean, what's the weirdest thing that you've ever written about?
The weirdest thing I've ever written about? I don't think I've ever written about anything too weird. Just like, I guess those random health issues in dogs. But I don't think there was anything too weird. Not yet.
So no horror stories then?
No, not yet. And let's hope not.
Yeah. Well, knowing what you know now, as a freelancer in your position, what would you have done differently at the start of your career?
I would probably got like invested in a coach or a mentor right from the start. It's a very hard step when you're starting out, and again, when you're not sure if it's going to work out, you're scared, you don't know how long will it take for you to get a client, so it's hard to do that investment. But I do think it makes a world of difference having someone that has already gone through the path that you're about to start. It makes a world of difference, really.
Do you have a coach or a mentor at the moment?
Yes, I do, and I love her. She's amazing. But yeah, but in the beginning, one thing that I did do, so it's kind of like the opposite question, but I did do, and I think was very well done, was the fact that I understood that I didn't have anyone close to me that was a freelancer and that was already doing what I wanted to do. So I knew I needed to focus on finding someone or a community that I could really latch on to and learn from. So this came about at a very good time, because as soon as I made the decision, like a few weeks after that, it was going to start the Future of Work conference. It was a remote conference, and I was like, I need to sign up for that. I need to meet as many people as I can within that conference, and to start building my own network, not for the sake of to get clients off of people, but to have people to share experiences with. Because I knew that if I came up to my friends with the problems I was facing at that time, they were either going to call me crazy or just tell me it was fine and I got this. And I knew that they didn't know what they were talking about. Like, as well intentioned as they were, it was hard for me to listen to that advice if it didn't came from someone that was already in the situation that I wanted to be in. And also one thing that was really, really important was finding an actual like content writer that I really followed everywhere. So in this case, it was Elna Kane. So she was the one that I saw like, well, if she can do it, then I can do it too. And this is so, so important. I think this is like the most important thought that you need to really hold on to, is finding someone that you see like they're human, they're not different than you like in any way. And if they're able to do it, so can you.
Yeah, that's true. I see a lot of people like that on Instagram who I get inspiration from, where I'm like, okay, they're doing these really cool things, so there's no reason that I can't do that. But then on the other side of things, on the other side of the coin, I get it where I'm looking at these so-called inspirations of mine, but then also getting kind of discouraged and depressed, you know, when you see like a 22-year-old driving, you know, a Lamborghini because he's done this, that, and the other, and it's sort of, okay, I'm comparing myself. I was like, why aren't I there? Like, why haven't I reached that? How do you sort of get a good balance of inspiration without just trying to like overcompete with the entire world?
I'd say ideally you would go with 1-2 people max that you really go listen to everything they're putting out, read everything, all the content they're putting out. But otherwise, if it's just random people where you're just getting the bits and pieces of them just showing off what they have, because we don't know the full picture, right? Like, it's easy to get fooled with what people are sharing online. So that's why it's important to really deeply follow one, two people tops, where you can, and if they have that vehicle of like showing what are they struggling with too, and or what were their struggles when they were at your point. Because if it's someone that just says like, oh look, I have this, now I have that, and doesn't really share anything else other than that, then there's not really a point in following it. Because what you want the most is seeing that they've also faced the same issues you're facing, and they still got to where they are. And that's what makes it seem more possible for you. Because if you only see the good side of what someone has, and you build this picture in your mind that they didn't have to face through any struggles and everything was just effortless for them, then you're not going to be able to really relate to that.
Yeah, that's true. That's a very good point that you made there, that like you want to see them go through the struggles that you've been through. Is that sort of like proof that you can do it as well, sort of like, so you can get that that inspiration. And I feel quite strongly about that. If you post a video or you make an online course or, you know, anything you post content to online claiming that you've done something. So here's how, you know, you see all these videos like, oh, here's how I made $1 million in 4 months. It should be policy on platforms like YouTube and even on like course platforms like Kajabi, where if you're making that claim, you should have to prove it. So like if you're saying like, oh, here's how I made $4 million in a month or whatever, you should have to have a bank statement that says you had $1 million enter that bank in that month. Like,
yeah,
you get this mixed version of reality. Like, okay, like why aren't I achieving that? Why, you know, how is everybody else doing this and that? And, you know, like you said, when people don't post like the full story of how they got to a certain situation, it gives like, you know, a completely different view of how things. I saw this really good meme the other day. It was this guy made a post about, he was like, oh, how I made $1 million in 2023. And it was like, I got, you know, 40,000 from a social media marketing contract. I got 1,000 from an online course, and I got 9,000 from coaching. And then I inherited $950,000. It's like, yeah, that's like probably, you know, a lot of things that you don't see that go on like that. But that verification thing would solve a lot of those.
Yeah, 100%. Also, when I see those, I always, because we always assume that's true, right? Because for most of us, it doesn't make sense that we would post those things without them being true. But the fact is that a lot of people do. And so having that verification would be perfect.
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of ironic as well, me speaking about this on this podcast. This podcast is literally called the 100K Freelancer Club podcast, right? But the thing is as well, one, I could prove that immediately, you know, making $100,000 a year. But the thing is with this podcast as well, it's like, our mission has always been to like help people and to get people into the world of freelancing just so they can live a lifestyle that they want to live. And I've talked about this before on the podcast. It's like, you know, really, it's just me and Chris looking for like more friends that can come and do cool shit with us around the world. Because if I ask my 9-to-5 friends to go skiing tomorrow in Austria, they can't do it. But so it's only the people that live the kind of lifestyle that we do that can actually do that. But even in terms of like, we've tried it before as well. Even before we launched the podcast, we did some split testing, and what we found is that, so you can see why people do this, but it's kind of a name like this gets much more engagement, much more like interaction. But now we go under the philosophy of sell them what they want and give them what they need. So we really do try and give the best information possible for somebody to, you know, to go on and make the, you know, the best out of their careers. And even being in the freelance world for most people isn't even about the money when it comes down to it. They just want the freedom to be able to work on what they want, when they want, and where they want. So you know, some people might be freelancing and making, you know, 30K a year and be the happiest person in the entire world. There might be other freelancers out there, like we've talked to on the podcast, that make, you know, 750K a year and they're still pushing for even more. But that's, you know, that's just them. And this whole lifestyle that we live really just comes down to, you know, being able to do what you want to do and what you value. So I'll push that over to you. And it's like, so what do you look for from freelance?
Yeah, so exactly what you mentioned. I look for the freedom. So initially, it's easy to get caught up in those monetary goals. But the fact is that if once you reach one goal, you'll always want the next, and then the next, and then the next. And so, and when are you going to actually be happy with how you're living life? Because if you want, like, you could either, you have to choose, like, do you want to work over 40 hours a week to earn, I don't know, 10K a month? Or would you rather work only 20 hours a week and earn 7K a month? And you'd be able to pay off all your bills, have enough money to enjoy your time with friends, to travel, but you'd only work 20 hours. So, and you wouldn't always be pursuing the monetary goal. So definitely that's what's important for me now. But in the beginning, I was really driven by like hitting the 10K, 15K. But yeah, if that means I'm going to be overworked, then I don't want it now. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I said, there's a lot more to life than just, you know, especially with digital freelancers, a lot more to life than being sat behind a screen. And so if you can find what you want from this lifestyle and live that, it's, you know, perfect. That is the beauty of what we do. So talking of that and trying to move on to how, you know, how can people get to, you know, the positions that we're into today as a freelancer, and maybe even as a solopreneur or a small business, how do people go about their own content? Like, I'll lay this out in a much more simple question, but do freelancers need a content strategy to grow their own business?
100%. So I always suggest people to have kind of one outbound strategy and one inbound strategy to get clients. So outbound, so you'll need to like be pitching your services. You'll need to be the one reaching out to people that might be interested in your services. But at the sooner you start investing in an inbound strategy, so where you put yourself out there for people to reach out to you, the better. And that comes with content strategy. So you need to be very clear with what is the service you're providing, who you're serving, and then creating content around that. And it is a long-term strategy. So again, it goes down to being consistent again. And there will be days where you feel like no one's listening to you. But with consistency, people will start to notice you and your content, and you'll be able to get to a point where people are reaching out to you rather than you having to reach out to them all the time.
Okay, and then, so I've got a follow-up question to that, which is, if you only had 2 hours a week to create content as a new freelancer focusing on growing your own business, what would you do?
I would bet all my cards on LinkedIn. I love LinkedIn. So that's definitely where I would be creating content to post on LinkedIn and mostly engaging with other people's content too. But being not engaging, just commenting like, great post, but really adding to what the people are saying instead of just commenting some generic stuff, just add your 2 cents on it too. Like, if you have a different take on it, then share it. Don't be afraid to share it. It might take some time, especially at first. And when you're a new freelancer, you don't really trust anything that you're thinking, but you'll definitely start seeing posts where you can actually add something there. But it takes time, it takes practice. As with everything, takes a lot of practice. But that's definitely what where I would spend those 2 hours.
Nice. Yeah, because for me, I've never really put much effort into LinkedIn as an individual or as a business. I mean, what are the tips and tricks for getting started with LinkedIn, as not as an individual but as a business? Do they differ from sort of personal growth and looking for, you know, to get gigs and freelance jobs as to a business? If somebody has a small business that they're trying to run as opposed to a personal brand, does that differ from those tactics?
From what I'm seeing, it's very similar, the strategy, since as a freelancer you're also like a small business owner, so you also have to face it that way. I'd say the only difference is it depends how you want to portray yourself. Would you want to have a company that will later on grow into something a lot bigger, where you'll bring other people, or would it always be like a one-man show or one-woman show? But it's still very important to have like the personal element to it, even if it's a company. So content-wise, I guess like if you're promoting yourself as a company, there isn't too much of your personal experience that you would take to create content. But you would replace this probably with your client's personal stories instead of your own personal story.
So always trying to keep it personal then. I guess to get that base level connection with the audience.
Exactly, 100%. And also especially in an era where we're holding on to a lot to AI, we need to bring those personal stories to the forefront a lot more. And draw from those a lot more, because it's if you ask ChatGPT to give you or give me like your personal experience on this, it won't come up with anything that is relatable. So we need to bring that into our content a lot more.
Yeah, that is true. I've just completed an experiment actually. So over the past 2 weeks, I've been conducting an experiment for a YouTube video I've been working on, which is basically freelancers versus AI. And I got a freelancer from Fiverr, a couple of freelancers from Fiverr, to produce short form content, so reels about freelancing. And then I also got AI to create the same thing. So to create short form content, and I went with the AI part, I only used AI. So ChatGPT made the script, made the thumbnails, and then over to, you know, different softwares to get the voiceover, to get the video, to do the video edit into the captions, all AI, and then all freelancer. And then I posted those to an Instagram page, and the results were actually, or to Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, and the results were actually crazy different. So the freelancers, on average, or on the totals, got 60% more views and engagement than the AI generated content. So we aren't quite there yet as to where we're not at the point of where AI is completely taken over and rendering people useless.
Yeah, of course not. I think it's crazy to assume that's going to happen. And especially like in the writing community, a lot of people are just really resistant to using ChatGPT and are really thinking, oh my God, it's going to replace us. And that's just proof that it's not. Also, because we need to be the brains behind the machine. So for AI to actually give us some good output, somebody needs to be there, like giving directions and giving him enough to go on. Because if I just tell him, write a LinkedIn post, he'll just write something random. But if I say, like, I'm a copywriter and I need a LinkedIn post that will talk about my experience with walking my dog, and I want you to aim at this. So I need to give him all that for it to be able to give me something back with some quality. And then I need to also go in and edit it and make it sound natural. Because we've all read those posts that are copy-paste from ChatGPT. They're horrible. They're just horrible. We know that. We can sniff them from miles away. So we always need to really tweak what it gives us. And it's going to take a long time, if ever, for us to actually be fooled with what comes from AI and what comes from an actual human.
Yeah, that's so true. You can, I don't know how, but yeah, you can just see it immediately that it's written and copy and pasted from AI. And it's just so blatantly obvious. I, you know, I don't know if that, how or how much that will improve in the future, but we had a podcast guest on recently, Georgia, who owns, or she created a hybrid copywriting agency where it's full of copywriters, the agency, but they're all highly trained and use AI to like its maximum capacity. You see this being a trend moving forward, that hybrid approach.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, because I think AI is here to make us be more efficient with our time. So a way that I use ChatGPT a lot is to get that horrible first draft out of the way. Because for me, what I usually do is I do my research. I know what I want to write, what points I want to touch. But when it comes to the actual writing, for me, it's a lot harder to write something on a blank page than it is to edit a horrible first draft. So that's, ChatGPT is my pal to get that horrible first draft out of the way. And it makes me so much faster at what I do. And so I do believe that AI is going to help us just become more efficient so we can have more time for us, for ourselves, and to enjoy the freedom that we so crave. So I think we need to see it as an ally rather than an enemy.
Yeah, that's true. I completely agree with you on that point. And then in terms of copywriting in general, so whether it's you writing the copy or it's AI writing the copy, why does a business need a copywriter? And what are they looking to get from a copywriter? Why can't they just write stuff themselves?
Right, because usually one thing that especially business owners miss a lot is taking the time to do proper research. And that's a huge, huge part of copywriting. So, and because usually what they think the problem of their audience is, it's not. It's something. It's always something else. And they need to go deeper on that and really do that research part that takes time. And there's usually not a lot of patience for that, but that's the really, really important. So getting into the same level that their audience is, meeting them where they're at, and then bringing up and creating the content so that the audience, first of all, is able to identify their own problem, because sometimes they might not even be aware of that, and then nurture them in a way that that business's service or product is really the only answer for their problem. But there's a lot of research, a lot of understanding of their audience that needs to go into the content strategy in order to do this. And I think that's what business owners miss most of the times, and where a copywriter really goes in and really saves the day in that sense.
Yeah, and I think in business as well, you should definitely be hiring experts in their fields. And business owners, especially small business owners, often make the mistake of thinking like, oh, I can do everything, but it's always better to leave it up to the experts. So if anybody needs a copywriter, they can get in touch. They can get in touch with you. And and on that note, I want to say a massive thank you for coming on the podcast today and talking with me and sharing your experiences with myself and the audience.
Thank you for having me. It was really great to have this time and to talk to you about it.
Yeah, nice. And if people do want to find you, whether they want to work with you, whether they want to view some of your content, where can they go to find you?
All right. So I'm mostly active on LinkedIn. You can find me with my name, so Beatriz Abreu Peixoto. So I'm not sure, you're going to have like some show notes, right? With along with the episode.
Yep.
So I guess
I'll put all the links in the description, in the show notes of this podcast as well.
Yeah, it's easier that way, because with my Portuguese name, it's going to be hard to spell it. And also, like, on my LinkedIn, you'll see that I have something new published. So I'm actually starting to offer brand new coaching services on top of my copywriting services. So as a way to help other freelancers and copywriters define their message and start creating content that will allow them to get noticed and get people reaching out to them. So, and whoever's listening, can't wait to see you on LinkedIn and just come say hi.
Awesome. Great stuff. One last massive thank you. And thank you everybody for listening to this episode of the podcast. Please remember to hit that subscribe button and we'll catch you in the next episode.